Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is The Power of the Market, Volume 1 of the 10-part public television series Free to Choose. America's freedom and prosperity derive from the combination of the idea of human liberty in America's Declaration of Independence and the idea of economic freedom in Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations. Economist Milton Friedman visits Hong Kong, the United States, and Scotland to explain how markets and voluntary exchanges organize activity and enable people to improve their lives. Listen now, and don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
It's a gorgeous morning around the New York metropolitan area. Skies are sunny now. A little bit of cloudiness over the eastern end of Long Island, a patchy fog out there. Boy, we've got some lovely weather to talk about. And I think I promised you this back at the beginning of the week.
Once all this was a swamp, covered with forests. The Canarsie Indians who lived here traded the 22 square miles of soggy Manhattan Island to the Dutch for $24 worth of cloth and trinkets. The newcomers founded a city, New Amsterdam, at the edge of an empty continent. In the years that followed, it proved a magnet for millions of people from across the Atlantic, people who were driven by fear and poverty, who were attracted by the promise of freedom and plenty. They fanned out over the continent and built a new nation, with their sweat, their enterprise, and their vision of a better future. For the first time in their lives, many were truly free to pursue their own objectives. That freedom released the human energies which created the United States. For the immigrants who were welcomed by this statue, America was truly a land of opportunity. They poured ashore in their best clothes, eager and expectant, carrying what little they owned. They were poor, but they all had a great deal of hope. Once they arrived, they found, as my parents did, not an easy life, but a very hard life. But for many, there were friends and relatives to help them get started, to help them make a home, get a job, settle down in a new country. There were many rewards for hard work, enterprise, and ability. Life was hard, but opportunity was real. There were few government programs to turn to and nobody expected them. But also, there were few rules and regulations. There were no licenses, no permits, no red tape to restrict them. They found, in fact, a free market, and most of them thrived on it. Many people still come to the United States driven by the same pressures and attracted by the same promise. You can find them in places like this. It's Chinatown in New York, one of the centers of the garment industry, a place where hundreds of thousands of newcomers have had their first taste of life in the new country. The people who live and work here are like the early settlers. They want to better their lot and they're prepared to work hard to do so.
Although I haven't often been in factories like this, it's all very familiar to me because this is exactly the same kind of a factory that my mother worked in when she came to this country for the first time at the age of 14, almost 90 years ago. And if there had not been factories like this here then at which she could have started to work and earned a little money, she wouldn't have been able to come. And if I existed at all, I'd be a Russian or a Hungarian today instead of American. Of course, she didn't stay here a long time. She stayed here while she learned the language, while she developed some feeling for the country, and gradually she was able to make a better life for herself. Similarly, the people who are here now, they are like my mother, mostly immigrants from a distant country. They came here because they liked it here better and had more opportunities. A place like this gives them a chance to get started. They're not going to stay here very long or forever. On the contrary, they and their children will make a better life for themselves as they take advantage of the opportunities that a free market provides to them.
The irony is that this place violates many of the standards that we now regard as every worker's right. It's poorly ventilated. It's overcrowded. The workers accept less than the union rate. It breaks every rule in the book. But if it were closed down, who would benefit? Certainly not the people here. Their life may seem pretty tough compared to our own, But that's only because our parents or grandparents went through that stage for us. We've been able to start at a higher point. Frank Fazzelli's father was 12 years old when he arrived all alone in the United States. He'd come from Sicily. That was 53 years ago. Frank is a successful dentist with a wife and family. They live in Lexington, Massachusetts.
Fine, one bottle fills the whole decanter.
There's no doubt in Frank's mind what freedom combined with opportunity meant to his father, and then to him, or what his Italian grandparents would think if they could see how he lives now.
They would not believe what they would see, that a person could immigrate from a small island and make such success out of their life, because to them they were mostly related to the fields, working in the field as a peasant. My father came over, he made something for himself, and then he tried to build a family structure. Whatever he did was for his family. It was for a better life for his family. And I can always remember him telling me that, you know, number one thing in life is you should get an education to become a professional person.
Johnny, please don't eat that.
You're
off
to be a master plasterer.
The Vasalli family, like all of us who live in the United States today, owe much to the climate of freedom we inherited from the founders of our country, a climate that gave full scope to the poor from other lands who came here and were able to make better lives for themselves and their children.
You girls gonna have this?
Yeah.
You, Chris? I know you don't want the whipped cream.
But in the past 50 years, we've been squandering that inheritance by allowing government to control more and more of our lives instead of relying on ourselves. We need to rediscover the old truths that the immigrants knew in their bones, what economic freedom is and the role it plays in preserving personal freedom. That's why I came here to the South China Sea. It's a place where there's an almost laboratory experiment in what happens when government is limited to its proper function and leaves people free to pursue their own objectives.
If you want to see how the free market really works, this is the place to come.
Hong Kong, a place with hardly any natural resources. About the only one you can name is a great harbor. Yet the absence of natural resources hasn't prevented rapid economic development. Ships from all nations come here to trade because there are no duties, no tariffs on imports or exports. The power of the free market has enabled the industrious people of Hong Kong to transform what was once barren rock into one of the most thriving and successful places in Asia. Aside from its harbor, the only other important resource of Hong Kong is people, over 4.5 million of them. Like America a century ago, Hong Kong in the past few decades has been a haven for people who sought the freedom to make the most of their own abilities. Many of them are refugees from countries that don't allow the economic and political freedom that's taken for granted in Hong Kong. Despite rapid population growth, despite the lack of natural resources, the standard of living is one of the highest in all of Asia. People work hard, but Hong Kong's success is not based on the exploitation of workers. Wages in Hong Kong have gone up fourfold since the war, and that's after allowing for inflation. The workers are free to work what hours they choose, free to move to other jobs if they wish. The market gives them that choice. It also determines what they make. You can be sure that somebody somewhere is willing to pay for these cheap plastic toys. Otherwise, they simply wouldn't be made. Competition from places like South Korea and Taiwan has made cheap products less profitable. So Hong Kong businessmen have been adapting. They've been developing more sophisticated products and new technology that can match anything in the West or East. And their employees have been developing new skills. Hong Kong never stops. There's always some business to be done, some opportunity to be seized. It's long been a tourist center and a shopper's paradise, and it's now one of the business centers of the East. It's the ordinary people of Hong Kong who benefit from all this effort and enterprise.
This thriving, bustling, dynamic city has been made possible by the free market, indeed the freest market in the world. The free market enables people to go into any industry they want, to trade with whomever they want, to buy in the cheapest market around the world, to sell in the dearest market around the world. But most important of all, if they fail, they bear the cost. If they succeed, they get the benefit. And it's that atmosphere of incentive that has induced them to work, to adjust, to save, to produce a miracle.
This miracle hasn't been achieved by government action, by someone sitting in one of those tall buildings telling people what to do. It's been achieved by allowing the market to work. Walk down any street in Hong Kong and you'll see the impersonal forces of the market in operation. Mr. Chung makes metal containers. Nobody's ordered him to. He does it because he's found that he can do better for himself that way than by making anything else. But if demand for metal containers went down, or somebody found a way of making them cheaper, Mr. Chung would soon get that message. A few doors away, Mr. Yu's firm has been making traditional Cantonese wedding gowns for 42 years. But the demand for these elaborate garments is falling. The firm has already gotten that message and is now looking for another product. The market tells producers not only what to produce, but how best to produce it through another set of prices, the cost of materials, the wages of labor, and so on. For example, if these workers could earn more doing something else, Mr. Ho would soon find a way to mechanize his picture frame production. Inside this Chinese medicine shop, a market transaction's going on. The customer's confidence that this painful-looking ordeal will help him doesn't rest on any official certification of the bone doctor's qualifications. It comes from experience, his own or his friend's. In his turn, the doctor treats him not because he's been ordered to, but because he gets paid. The transaction is voluntary, so both parties must expect a benefit or it will not take place. Believe it or not, this backyard is the entrance to a factory. The workers here are some of the best paid in Hong Kong. It's hot, sticky, and extremely noisy. The workers are highly skilled, so they can command high wages. They could induce their employer to improve working conditions by offering to work for less, but they would rather accept the conditions, take the high wages, and spend them as they wish. That's their choice. The best known statement of the principles of a free market, the kind of free market that operates in Hong Kong, was written on the other side of the world. Two 200 years ago in Scotland, Adam Smith taught at the University of Glasgow. His brilliant book, The Wealth of Nations, was based on the lectures he gave here.
The basic principles underlying the free market, as Adam Smith taught them to his students in this university, are really very simple. Look at this lead pencil. There's not a single person in the world who could make this pencil. Remarkable statement? Not at all. The wood from which it's made, for all I know, comes from a tree that was cut down in the state of Washington. To cut down that tree, it took a saw. To make the saw, it took steel. To make the steel, it took iron ore. This black center, we call it lead, but it's really graphite, compressed graphite. I'm not sure where it comes from, but I think it comes from some mines in South America. This red top up here, the eraser, bit of rubber, probably comes from Malaya, where the rubber tree isn't even native. It was imported from South America by some businessmen with the help of the British government. This brass ferrule, I haven't the slightest idea where it came from, or the yellow paint, or the paint that made the black lines, or the glue that holds it together. Literally thousands of people cooperated to make this pencil. People who don't speak the same language, who practice different religions, who might hate one another if they ever met. When you go down to the store and buy this pencil, you are in effect trading a few minutes of your time for a few seconds of the time of all those thousands of people. What brought them together and induced them to cooperate to make this pencil? There was no commissar sending out orders from some central office. It was the magic of the price system, the impersonal operation of prices that brought them together and got them to cooperate to make this pencil so that you could have it for a trifling sum. That is why the operation of the free market is so essential, not only to promote productive efficiency, but even more, to foster harmony and peace among the peoples of the world.
These people are crossing between two very different societies. This is Lo Wu, the official border crossing point between China and Hong Kong. Nowadays, there's a considerable amount of traffic at this border. People cross a little more freely than they used to. Many people from Hong Kong trade in China, and the market has helped bring the two countries closer together. But the barriers between them are still very real.
On this side of the border, people are free not only in the marketplace, but in all their lives. They are free to say what they want, to write what they want, to do pretty much as they please. Not so over there. That is why people in China who cannot get permission to leave go to desperate lengths to escape. They risk their lives in the process. Many lose their lives, but that doesn't keep others from following. Some are attracted by the higher material standard of life in Hong Kong, but more by the natural human desire to be free.
The people who get official permission to leave China are fortunate. They're going to be able to enjoy the benefits of the economic freedom they'll find in Hong Kong. But more important, that will give them a much wider freedom.
Human and political freedom has never existed and cannot exist without a large measure of economic freedom. Those of us who have been so fortunate as to have been born in a free society tend to take freedom for granted, to regard it as a natural state of mankind. It is not. It is a rare and precious thing. Most people throughout history, most people today, have lived in conditions of tyranny and misery, not of freedom and prosperity. The clearest demonstration of how much people value freedom is the way they vote with their feet when they have no other way to vote.
Of course, many of the people who pour into Hong Kong will end up in conditions that most of us in the West would find appalling. Hong Kong is very far from utopia. It has its slums, It's crime. It's desperately poor people. But the people are free. That's, after all, why so many of them have come here, despite having to live in leaky houseboats in one of Hong Kong's many small harbors. Here, they have the freedom and the opportunity to better themselves, to improve their lot, and many succeed. There's appalling poverty in Hong Kong, it's true, but the conditions of the people have been getting better over time. They're far better off now than they were when they first came across the border from China. And that poverty, appalling to us, because we're accustomed to much higher standards of life, is not poverty as viewed by most of the people in the world. It's a poverty to which they would aspire, a state of affairs that they would like to achieve. There is an enormous amount of poverty in the world everywhere. There is no system that's perfect. There's no system that's going to eliminate completely poverty in whatever sense. The question is, which system has the greatest chance? Which is the best arrangement for enabling poor people to improve their lot? And on that, the evidence of history speaks with a single voice. I do not know any exception to the proposition that if you compare like with like, the freer the system, the better off the ordinary poor people have been. Ask yourself what it is that assures these garment workers in Hong Kong a good wage. Not high by Western standards, but high enough to enable them to live far better than most people in the world. It's not government or trade unions who do it. These workers do well because there's competition for their labor and skills.
When a businessman faces trouble, a market threatens to disappear, or a new competitor arises, there are two things he can do. He can turn to the government for a tariff or a quota or some other restriction on competition, or he can adjust and adapt. In Hong Kong, the first option is closed. Hong Kong is too dependent on foreign trade so that the government has simply had to adopt a policy of complete non-interference. That's tough on some individuals, but it's extremely healthy for the society as a whole. Only the businessmen who can adapt, who are flexible and adjustable, survive, and they create good employment opportunities for the rest. The complete absence of tariffs or any other restrictions on trade is one of the main reasons why Hong Kong has been able to provide such a rapidly rising standard of life for its people.
Even Communist China recognizes Hong Kong's success. It set up shop here and now accepts the universal symbol of capitalism. The Bank of China, the official bank of Communist China, is the largest bank in Hong Kong. There's no doubt that Communist China recognizes the power of the market. In all this, the government of Hong Kong has played an important part, not only by what it has done, but as much by what it has refrained from doing. It has made sure that laws are enforced and contracts honored. It has provided the conditions in which a free market can work. Most importantly, it has not tried to direct the economic activities of the colony.
No government official is telling these people what to do. They're free to buy from whom they want, to sell to whom they want, to work for whom they want. Sometimes it looks like chaos, and so it is. But underneath, it's highly organized by the impersonal forces of a free marketplace.
Fresh eggs here. Chicken wing, chicken leg. You know where these eggs are from? Right from the chicken's ass. Ask me no questions. Tell you no lie.
The impersonal forces of a free marketplace at work, back here in the United States.
Hey, two broccoli, a dollar quarter.
Prices are the key. The prices that people are willing to pay for products determines what's produced. The prices that have to be paid for raw materials, for the wages of labor and so on, determine the cheapest way to produce these things. And in addition, these self-same prices, the wages of labor, the interest on capital, and so on, determine how much each person has to spend on the market. It's tempting to try to separate this final function of prices from the other two, to think that somehow or other you can use prices to transmit the information about what should be produced and how it should be produced without using those prices to determine how much each person gets. Indeed, government activity over the past few decades has been devoted to little else. But that's a very serious mistake. If what people get is not going to be determined on what they produce, on how they produce it, on how successfully they work, what incentive is there for them to act in accordance with the information that's transmitted? There's only one alternative: force. Some people telling other people what to do.
We got them, folks. Let's go ahead. We got parsley here. 30 cents.
Hey, look at these melons, $2. Hey, fresh melons, $2.
Hey, two broccoli, $1.
Hey, look at those there again, Charlie.
I know, huh?
Go ahead, try them, huh? Nice. Oh boy, look what I got. Real good tomato. Real nice. Hey, come on, try one of those tomatoes here. Don't eat home anymore. Have free lunch over here. You eat for nothing over here. Go ahead, eat. We don't charge you. Have a free lunch.
I know, I'm going to.
That's right. Free lunch, free lunch.
The fundamental principle of a free society is voluntary cooperation. The economic market, buying and selling, is one example. But it's only one example. Voluntary cooperation is far broader than that. To take an example that at first sight seems about as far away as you can get, the language we speak, the words we use, the complex structure of our grammar. No government bureau designed that. It arose out of the voluntary interactions of people seeking to communicate with one another. Or consider some of the great scientific achievements of our time, the discoveries of an Einstein or a Newton, the inventions of a Thomas Alva Edison, or an Alexander Graham Bell, or even consider the great charitable activities of a Florence Nightingale or an Andrew Carnegie. These weren't done under orders from a government office. They were done by individuals deeply interested in what they were doing, pursuing their own interests and cooperating with one another. This kind of voluntary cooperation is built so deeply into the structure of our society that we tend to take it for granted. Yet the whole of our Western civilization is the unintended consequence of that kind of a voluntary cooperation, of people cooperating with one another to pursue their own interests, yet in the process building a great society.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.